welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment, and each week on the show, we bring to you different thought leaders, activists, advocates, scientists, authors, doctors, filmmakers, poets, journalists, editors, talking to you about the different facets of our interconnected world and how they impact our health and well-being, our personal health and well-being, the well-being of our communities, the well-being of our society, and the ecological balance of our habitat, planet Earth. And each week on the show, we talk about all of the different things that make up that interconnection. I also report on Alternet, Truthout, Truthdig, and other publications, and I'm on Facebook under Connecting the Dots for Health. We've been talking about food a lot this season. Obviously, there's a lot going on many of the fronts that this show has covered during the last 7 or 8 years that we've been on the air, fracking, pipelines, climate, all kinds of public policies are under attack in our world. And among them is you know, one of the most foundational, which is food and the health of our food system. So since about August, we've put a real focus on that. We're going to talk about it again today with a really terrific author and journalist. You can go back into our archives and talk about recent happenings in the food policy world. You know, listen to shows where we talk with various guests about, you know, some of the basics of our food supply and the interaction between that and our climate. On today's show, I'm really honored to welcome Barry Estabrook. He is an author who's really zeroed in on the problem with modern industrial agriculture. This is something that we take for granted, or at least many people do, you know, with the notion of if it wasn't safe and healthy for us, it wouldn't be out there. But there's a lot going on behind the scenes that can't readily be discerned just by looking at a tomato. Barry is actually the author of a book we'll be discussing today among his other reporting and interests. And the book is called Tomato Land, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. And, you know, that's kind of going to be a starting point for us because we're not going to just focus exclusively on one fruit. But his drill into that, which raised a lot of eyebrows and a lot of consciousness on this issue, is something that we really need to look at because we kind of, you know, many people like myself, for example, are organic food diehards or sustainable and healthy food diehards. But many people really, you know, it's like a fruit is a fruit is a fruit. And we, you know, many people don't really track that our food agricultural system is not something that's just kind of eternal. It's something that evolved in a particular time period, has grown and spread, and, you know, has certain lasting impacts. So I'm delighted to welcome to today's show author and journalist Barry Estabrook. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So, you know, as you have done your deep dive into what's going on behind the scenes in our food system, what was your first surprise, like what you didn't know when you first began looking into this in terms of the kind of problem that's going on there, the scope of it, the, you know, kind of lack of understanding about it? What has been like the biggest and sort of most persistent surprise for you?
Well, I think the entire industrial food system, from the farms to the supermarket to the fast food restaurant, is based on hiding the truth behind what's really going on. It's based on fooling the consumer, and you know, it works wonderfully for industrial food food producers, but for consumers, it's a terrible deal. It's you know, you have no idea what that piece of meat that's sitting in a cello-wrapped styrofoam tray, what it really represents. It's just sitting there, or that beautiful red tomato in the produce stand. And well, what I quickly found out is, you know, a tomato is not a tomato. A pork chop isn't a pork chop. There's a huge story behind how they're produced that makes them, you know, very, very different. I think in
and
a way
people,
we've, in a way
people,
we've,
sorry?
In a way that as a nation we've become illiterate about our food supply. We really don't know, and this is wonderful for industrial food producers.
In place of not knowing, people are assuming that it's safe, that it's healthy, that it's okay. You know, any given food that they're eating, it's convenient. And, of course, there's also the myth that this kind of food is feeding the world. As you've looked into it, you know, is it safe? Is it healthy? Is it really okay? You know, if you could pick a few examples of where you've looked into things and they are, you know, they don't meet those expectations that most people assume the food wouldn't even be available without them.
Well, you know, I chose the tomato as a subject of one of my books because industrial tomatoes, you know, a lot of us in the so-called food movement, you know, throw around these catchphrases almost like mantra, you know, local, seasonal, fresh, organic. And, you know, it's almost like a mantra, and the words sort of become meaningless. But if you strip all those things away, all the things that we think of in the good food as good food, you end up with, the poster child for that is the bright red tomato in your supermarket. That tomato in Florida, which is where most winter tomatoes, whole tomatoes, are still produced, that tomato could have been blasted by over 100 different pesticides, fumigants, fungicides. 30 of those 100 are among the most toxic chemicals in agriculture's arsenal. The tomato that you buy today in a supermarket has like a third less vitamin C, for instance, than the tomato my mother would have brought home from the supermarket in the Kennedy era. A third, you know, calcium, everything, you know, it's just nearly as nutritious as a tomato was 50 years ago. One place it does beat the old tomato is it's got 14 times as much sodium, which we don't need. The flavor is gone. The pleasure of eating a tomato is completely gone. You don't know what a tomato tastes like unless you grow your own or go to the farmer's market or have a neighbor that grows tomatoes. The flavor is literally gone. It's been bred out of these tomatoes. Mm. And then I subsequently found out that the people who harvest these tomatoes, you know, they all have to be, fresh tomatoes have to be hand-picked. Those people were laboring at the very bottom of the workforce in the United States. In fact, until 7 or 8 years ago, slavery, abject slavery, was commonplace. So you think you're buying a nice red tomato, and they are beautiful looking, but the backstory is of a tasteless, nutrition-deprived fruit that depends on the worst labor abuses in the country to reach your supermarket. So, you know, this is a story that the food retail industry doesn't want you to think about. They just like you to look at those tomatoes and think, oh, that's pretty.
Now, you just mentioned that there are so many chemicals in one single tomato that somebody might eat. I mean, that is truly shocking. Why are all of those chemicals used? Are they needed? I mean, what's going on? Why is that happening?
Well, like I said earlier, Florida for wintertime, you know, this time of year, fresh tomatoes, not canned tomatoes. That's a whole different industry. They may as well be bananas or oranges. But mm-hmm. fresh tomatoes are mostly grown in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And you think of Florida as, you know, sunshine state or whatever, but a tomato looks at it differently. Florida is notoriously humid. And everything that would kill a tomato, every bug, every germ, every fungus spore that would kill a tomato, thrives in humidity.
Mm-hmm.
You would be a fool to grow a commercial tomato in Florida for biological reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is it's warm when much of the country is cold, and it's close to the eastern seaboard. And so it's marketing and business that dictates that tomatoes should be growing there. In order to get a crop, you have to battle all of these disease organisms and insects that thrive in that humidity. And that's why, you know, you shouldn't be growing tomatoes in a place like Florida. In order to, you have to wage what amounts to chemical warfare.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
is
by contrast,
the situation with the tomato unique? In other words, is it true of other fruits and vegetables as well, that they are grown in an inappropriate environment, that they are chock full of you know, this array of chemicals to because of that? I mean, is this common, or is the tomato unique in that way?
No, like I said, I think the tomato is kind of a poster child. It may be the most extreme example, but it's everything, you know, almost any industrial farm product, whether it's a fruit, vegetable, or even a piece of meat or a chicken, has similar problems, because you're taking a biological process, right? Something growing. It's a natural biological process. And you're trying to take that round peg, if I can say that, and fit it into the square hole of the industrial model. It's not an industrial mechanical thing. It's a biological thing. And the minute you try to do that, in other words, working against nature instead of with nature, you run into similar, you know, problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And why do they do this?
Well, it's all about money. It's all about, you know, we have a very inexpensive food in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And the, you know, it's been, you know, especially since the advent of the giant supermarkets, and of course Walmart's the biggest supermarket of all, there's been like a rush to the bottom in terms of price, cheaper at all costs. And so that means you get into these situations where, you know, you're using all these chemicals and whatnot in order to increase yields and fight back insects that, you know, you otherwise wouldn't necessarily be dealing with if you were growing in more appropriate quantities and places and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So then this becomes the MO, because they have to financially grow in this aggregated way at that kind of volume. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, you get cheap food, but there's a horrendous environmental cost. Wrecking the soil. We're basically, you know, strip mining our soil right now in the Midwest. You know, we've lost nearly half the topsoil that was there when we first started plowing that land 150 years ago, half of it's gone. I mean, it's been mined, basically. And it's, you know, we're it's just an unsustainable process.
Mm-hmm.
what does it mean? I mean, you know, to someone who's not familiar with farming, with gardening, you know, people think they can put a man on Mars. You know, we have all these technological advances. So, you know, why would it be a problem if we degrade the soil? Couldn't it simply be put back?
Well, that's the thinking. You know, that's that's the industrial mechanical thinking. But biology, life forces, doesn't work that way. You know, there's the soil is not just dirt. It's amazingly complex, and as soil scientists get, you know, learn more and more, it's a whole universe of animals and bacteria and tiny microscopic creatures that live in there, and they live in a symbiotic relationship with the plants. You know, some of them attach to the roots of plants and help the plants actually absorb nutrients. Some of them, you know, create passageways that water can get through the soil to plants' roots. It's all interconnected. And so when you hit a field with, say, a chemical fertilizer, the plant will grow, but the life in the soil will die. And without that, soil, you know, washes away, it blows away, and so you're draining, you know, you're basically draining a bank account that took tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years to build up, which is our topsoil, by this method. You know, what if I were to come up with an invention that was required no energy inputs whatsoever? This is how we can feed, you know, no energy inputs. It's a solar system. No mechanical inputs whatsoever. You didn't. You wouldn't have to fertilize, because that would happen, you know, naturally. Well, that's what gardening was, or farming was, before industrialization. You know, it was solar powered. The sun, you know, photosynthesis created the plants, created the carbon, was put in the soil. The decaying plant matter and manure from animals that were raised in conjunction with the plants fertilized the soil. And, you know, it would get better with every passing season, not worse.
So that's what's meant by regenerative agriculture, the notion that you build up rather than take and strip down. And, you know, so now there's a new phrase to describe that, because we have developed and gone with a process for short-term financial gain that basically strips down rather than builds up. You know, I mean, when you think about it, I mean, I don't know if you looked into this in your research in your book or not, but how did we get into this mentality and come to take it for granted?
Well, you know, the industrial agriculture is that we know is sort of a product of, started out really with a product of some of the chemicals that were developed during the Second World War, which produced pesticides and, you know, then to protect soldiers or whatever, insect killers, and also the basic mechanism to create industrial fertilizers, which, you know, are chemically not too different from explosives, some of the same elements. So at the end of the war, they had the technology there, and just began applying it to agriculture and had remarkable, what seemed like remarkable short-term results. You know, yields increased. You didn't have to keep animals on your farm anymore. You could just, and the point is it is short-term. It's not, as it's an overused word, but it is not sustainable. And you mentioned regenerative agriculture, which is a very interesting direction. It's sort of organic agriculture on steroids, in that the farmers who practice that are attempting to basically put back into the soil, move the clock back to the toward the time before there was agriculture, you know, recreate that life in the soil, that balance. And, you know, each season your land should not only be sustained, it should be improved. And I've seen some remarkable results. You know, cattle ranches regeneratively farmed where after a few seasons they're carrying twice as many cows on the same land, and you know, the land keeps getting better and better each season. Phenomenal, and phenomenally can happen very, you know, start happening very quickly. So it's got a lot of promise. And it, in field crops, it means not tilling, not cultivating the soil, allowing the you know, the residues, the debris and residues from last year's crops to stay on the land and get ground back into the soil rather than or decay back into the soil rather than being, you know, having a plow come and turn the soil over. So it's got great promise, I think.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is it's going back to practices that were more similar to what was done in traditional agriculture, is now, you know, coming back around, and, you know, being a new prospect, a new opportunity. It's kind of extraordinary. I mean, I don't know if you can do percentages, but, you know, we certainly have had a growing movement in organic agriculture with more and, you know, more people wanting to eat this kind of food. And yet many people, for, you know, price reasons and availability reasons, are sort of stuck in this declining and, you know, costly on so many levels that you're describing food model. Do you have any sense of, is it really cost that's keeping poor people unable to afford, you know, the healthier food, sort of stuck in the food system? Or do you think it's an educational issue? Or, you know, what have you observed about that?
Well, I guess the first thing I would say, and I get that question a lot, isn't this elitist? You know, it's great for you to say that. You can afford these organic vegetables and grass-fed beef, and you can get them. And, you know, the first thing I say, the problems are not food's fault. It's not the food's fault. It's poverty's fault. So you're blaming the wrong thing. You say organic food is expensive. Well, it's the problem is that there's still a level of poverty in this country, and there are still food deserts in this country. Not the food itself. I mean, I would argue that our food is too inexpensive. Too inexpensive because, you know, it's 50%. We spend 50% less of our salaries on food than even modern European people in modern European countries. And we have in terms of our income, we have by far the cheapest food in the world. And, you know, what that's resulted in is this what we've been talking about environmentally. And what it's resulted in is, you know, you can go into the Central Valley of California right now, one of the, you know, the biggest agricultural area in the country in terms of fruits and vegetables. And you'll find that up to 50% of the farm workers, the people who harvest that food, plant it, are food insecure. That's a term that means they're not guaranteed to have a decent meal today. 50%. Why is that? Because they're paid so little. Why is that? Because it's all about cheap food. So, you know, cheap food. food creates its own poverty, which is something that a lot of people don't think about until you see how farm workers are living. So, you know, what I say is that you shouldn't be concentrating on making food cheaper. You should be concentrating on somehow having programs that alleviate the poverty and that take care of the issue of getting food into the so-called food deserts, the areas that really don't have proper supermarkets and things like that.
Hi, returning to listeners and to our guests today for the second half of the show. Apologies, we seem to have had a sort of slight technical glitch, and hopefully we have that problem solved. So just returning to the question. Hi, Barry. Sorry
Hello.
For that little break. The question I was asking you is, why have people who are more conscious and committed to eating organic food, eating healthy food, made it, you know, a major priority to extend high-quality food to all people in our society?
Well, I mean, it's true that the organic good food, clean food is the fastest growing segment of the food industry.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, even though it's the fastest growing, it's still relatively small. It's still less than, in most cases, depending on the product, but still, say, less than 10%
mm-hmm.
Of you know, the food. So it's you're talking about a very small sliver,
mm-hmm.
no matter how you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so while it's growing and while it's becoming more popular, it still has a very long way to go before it becomes a huge force. I mean, the difference today, I think, than maybe 15 years ago is most people now have a choice. You can buy organic. I mean, it's available. You can buy free range. You can buy grass-fed. It's, you know, 15 years ago, you would, you know, if you wanted to have properly raised pork chop, you would probably have to either raise the pig yourself or know a pig farmer who raised the pig properly. Now, you know, even the local butcher will carry good meat, and there's national companies that sell it. So it's changing for the better, but it's, you know, it's still got a long way to go. And along the lines of what I was saying before, you know, there are people in this country, sadly, who genuinely cannot afford organic food. I mean, it's sad, but I accept that. But if you look at the country as a whole, there's a lot more people, a huge percentage of people who can afford it, but who choose not to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where organic needs to grow. You know, people who drive an expensive automobile or have the latest iPhone or, you know, wear running shoes that cost $200 or purchase jeans that already have holes in them that cost $100 and yet say food is expensive, to them mm-hmm. I say no, you're prioritizing. It's not, you know, you're saying, I would rather spend my money on, you know, these other types of things than on something as important and fundamental as the food that I eat and feed my family.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's that big group of, you know, too often we bog down on the issue as, well, it's organic, it's so expensive, some people can't afford it. True and mm-hmm. sad. And we need to do something about that. But we shouldn't forget about the huge majority of people who can afford it
mm-hmm.
and opt not to.
Mm-hmm. If you could redesign the food system, in other words, if it was up to you, you know, the way of a magic wand and say, you know, I have to go and here's what I would like to see happen. Here's what I think we should, you know, we can and should do that would really, you know, shift this entire problem where we have people stuck in a situation, or in certain cases, opting into a situation where instead of building a regenerative, healthy food supply, we're kind of going, okay, it's a pioneering effort. Maybe I'll participate. Maybe I won't. You know, if you could shift that, what would you propose? Have you ever thought about that?
I have, in fact. And I'd like a magic wand. There's a lot I would do with it. but mm-hmm. as far as I see it as a two-pronged, you've got to come at it from the food system from two directions. Sadly, I'm dead certain I won't be around to see the end of industrial agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one prong is to improve that, you know, and it's starting. Like, maybe you don't need to apply so much pesticide. Maybe you could, you know, use what they call integrative pest management, which is using your brain as well as your pesticide sprayer. You know, you don't just go out and spray, you analyze, you can reduce your pesticides. Go to no-till agriculure, which means no plowing underground over the ground every year. Just let the soil community rebuild that way.
Mm-hmm.
Go more humane ways of raising livestock industrially, avoiding the horrific drugs that they feed to pigs and chickens in these crowded CAFOs. You can make big progress there. At the same time, we need to help support the people who are at the organic, the regenerative people, help support that so that it too can grow. So you would have more well-raised food available. And you would also have an industrial system that wasn't as harmful. There are some big things that could be eliminated and would make industrial agriculture not perfect by any means, but much less harmful. At the same time as you can encourage the ecologically sound sector of agriculture to expand.
How would you encourage? Like, what would encouragement look like?
Well, I'm encouraged, and it's what I said earlier, that it's still small. Then that can be discouraging when you think, oh my God, only something like 3% of the beef that we eat in this country is grass finished. 97% of the beef we eat, the cows go to these vast feedlots to be fattened on grain. 3%, you can get really depressed. But you know, I can go out and buy. I live in the Northeast. I can go out to a little local butcher shop and buy grass-fed beef now. You know, it's 10 miles down the road on the way into the nearest sizable city.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't have dreamed of doing that 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and as far, you know, farmers markets are now everywhere and doubling, tripling over the last, you know, few years. Well, you know, so there you can get these products that you couldn't have dreamed of gotten, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So the hopeful sign is that it's now it's becoming more of a personal choice. You're running out of excuses, if you know what I mean. You can't say it's too inconvenient to get a pasture-raised pork chop. Well, no, that was true before, but now you can. So it's becoming more of a choice. There's more opportunity, and I see that as hopeful, because ultimately, the thing about food is, unlike so much else, we make the choices.
Well,
we get to choose when we're at the grocery store.
Is it just that we need to make the choices on a consumer level, and then it will all kind of take care of you know, itself? I mean, you know, how would you go about revolutionizing the food system? Would you do it, you know, in terms of exhorting consumers, you know, vote with your pocketbook? I mean, that's what people have been doing. It has grown to a certain degree. I mean, what, you know, is that the best way to do it in your sense? Or, you know, what do you, you know, what do you feel about that?
I think that's important because it's consumers who are now making the choice.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more important than some people give it credit for being.
I see. Well, let me ask you.
And then so it becomes a question of consumer education. And
I see. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you've never eaten a pasture-raised pork chop, say, from a heritage pig, until you've tried one, you don't. It's marvelous. It's a otherworldly pork chop compared to the dry, bland stuff you find in the supermarkets. And once you've kind of done that, it's hard to go back. And so more and more people could do that. And we were talking about organic earlier.
Mm-hmm.
There's never been a law passed anywhere that says you must buy organic. There's been very little government, even just government support for organic farming. Nothing. Yet, it's the fastest growing sector of the food business. So I think these things can have profound changes. It's not
well,
to be...
What about the recent, changes to the organic standards? We just had a situation where, over the last 20 years, you know, we've had the organic standards. People are, making their consumer choices known accordingly. And yet we just had this change in law, that was not what consumers wanted.
Well, you know, that's truly it's a Pandora's box, right? I think it's a shame. This latest round where the organic standards board proposed allowing hydroponic agriculture mm-hmm. to be organic. I'm not sure if organic is it's certainly not the gold standard that it once was or that it promised to be.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few things you can that there were no serious bad chemical fertilizers or pesticides sprayed on the food, so it's got things like that going for it. But as far as being a it's slowly being taken over by the industrial growers. So worries me that standard is going to be... I mean, you've got these huge corporations now planning to build enormous warehouse-style greenhouses and, feed the plants hydroponically, meaning they have they don't grow in soil. You know, they're just growing in some sort of inert medium, and fed everything everything they get is fed to them artificially, and they'll be calling themselves organic now, and it's getting so far away from what organic is really about that I'm.
I mean, my question is, I agree that consumer demand help grow the industry, help grow that kind of growing and encourage it. And now, we have this inclusion. We couldn't prevent it. We did not prevent it. And it's actually a challenge to the very growers that have been, it's an economic challenge to the very growers that have been supporting this. How is it that more of the same, more consuming buying can really overcome that challenge. How do you see that happening?
I'm sorry, Allison, but I'm having the difficulty hearing you again.
Okay.
Now I can hear you. Sorry.
Well, you know, it's always the permanent phone problem. But I'm just saying that because of the fact that in this organic movement, through consumer choice, and it was nevertheless overcome by the very companies who piggybacked on that, how can more consumer choice be used as a mechanism to support healthy agriculture today and turn that around? Or is there another mechanism that consumers or other people need to, you know, be pressing on? Because choice alone, which we were just discussing as being, you know, our best option, hasn't been able to secure the very things we were choosing.
Yeah, and I also think that, you know, it's very unfair to the people who are still being very true, farmers who are being very true to the original organic standards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there may be, we may need to, I hate to say it, there may be need some other certification. That's the last thing it seems like we need, but I don't think you can, you know, it's happened in dairy. You have these massive, massive farms where the cows don't even get outside, certainly don't get to spend any time, real time on pasture, that are certified organic.
Mm-hmm.
It's not what organic's about. Organic's about cows roaming around on pasture, but they can be certified. It's the same with egg production, you know, mega farms. That's not true to the spirit, but we certainly have those. And it's not fair to the person who's really doing it right, to, you know, a person farming a small organic farm is very different from a corporation that builds a huge modern climate-controlled hydroponic greenhouse, and it's going to be a problem, I think, and sadly, it seems like every year they whittle a little more away from the organic standards. And I don't know where this is going to end.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think should be done about that, or could be done about that, or would, if you could wave a magic wand?
Wand again.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because we have to project some kind of vision, you know, other than grooming it and kind of going along with it in some way, if we really want to defend and protect a healthy food supply.
Well, I think that, you know, people are, in the organic movement, are looking into just, you know, literally looking into sort of a category that's beyond organic, that would include things like leaving, you know, your animals on pasture for a certain amount of time, or not using hydroponic, you know, soilless growing systems. So there's talk. I mean, I know that there was a serious meeting of an organic farming organization in the Northeast following the latest announcement about hydroponics, where that was brought up is maybe somehow have to find a different definition that hasn't been co-opted.
Mm-hmm.
To, again, just out of fairness. If my cows are out on the pasture all the time and eating good grass and everything, and yours are kept in a confined building and never see the light of days, yours will probably give more milk and be cheaper than mine.
Mm-hmm.
But mine are certainly, you know, hewing more closely to what organic was supposed to be about.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. So are you referring to the BioNutrient Association recent meeting, or, you know, other meetings that you're aware of that have been occurring recently in the aftermath of this terrible vote by the National Organic Standards Board?
I live in Vermont, which is, you know, tiny, but it was the Vermont organic farming organization that sort of held a Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, just by virtue of the nature of our state, you know, we don't have a lot of we have some big dairy farms, but we don't have a lot of big, the type of organic operation that, you know, is bordering on industrial.
Mm-hmm.
I think Sam Frommerts in his book Organic Inc. called it industrial organic agriculture.
So basically they have the name organic, they change the methods, and, you know, so we've basically been the lead goat in drawing people, to this opportunity, and then these other folks kind of come along and then they cash in on it.
Exactly. It's corporate. It started out, I think, you know, where people had bought in philosophically to the principles of organic, right? The pioneers. They were, and once corporate interests saw that there was money to be made, you know, these companies certainly had never bought into the original theory of what organic is supposed to be. But they saw money was going to be made. They wanted a slice of the action. And having no philosophical, proclivities to be organic, they've been, all of a sudden there's pressure, downward pressure on the standards.
Well, one of the things that, I am very much in support of regenerative agriculture and for people who really are committed and understand the difference, and we teach more people that difference, to, make a stand there. And I think that would be excellent. I also really wonder if people who care about this should be voting with their pocketbooks in terms of, for example, not buying Clif Bars, or something that, the Clif Bar company was on the wrong side of this issue. And, you can call a convenience bar organic, but, the fact is it's filled with sweeteners and all kinds of things. It's not really hewing to Michael Pollan's view that, you vote at the edges of the, you vote as a consumer by purchasing, the real fruits and vegetables and the original produce and meats and dairy, if you eat that rather than all of these, kind of complicated products that are made up, and they've wrote along on the name organic in order to co-opt the movement. And I personally, would love to see something where they're not rewarded for having cashed in and taken it over. So that's just that's my particular. I think we need more ideas, frankly. We're in a very adverse situation environmentally, and I think the sustainable agriculture idea is a terrific idea. I think regenerative agriculture is a great idea, but I think we also need more ideas, and that consumers need to think beyond just my individual food purchase. In my view, that hasn't won. That hasn't won the day. It built the movement, and then it got co-opted. So, more of the same is, it's not dealing constructively, and really innovatively with an ever-mounting problem. And I honestly feel that we have to upscale our engagement and our attempts at saying more daring things and putting different things out there, because we already tried, this wonderful thing of voting with my pocketbook. I mean, I've been doing it for 30 years or more. And then, the result is because we also buy crackers and food bars and all these auxiliary products that we maybe really don't need, that we end up with a adulterated organic label. So that's just, I really think we have to go further demand more of ourselves if we really care to have a healthy supply and not just go, well, I'll do what's convenient while shopping.
then what's convenient is that this is the way business is done. They took over, la-da-da. That's, you know, that's too bad. You know, I think we have to become smarter rather than allow this to happen.
I totally agree, and it's a little bit of a cliche, but it's an important, it's something that's very important, is if it's at all possible, you should try to get familiarize yourself with the people who are feeding you. And the easiest way for that is to you know, go to the farmer's market and you can meet them. And you can, it requires effort. It's more effort than most people would probably do. But, you know, if you do that, then you know whether you're being hoodwinked or not. Similarly with a lot of natural food stores. You know, they go out of their way to, you know, be transparent of who their producers are and how they're produced, how the food's produced. So it requires more homework on the point of the consumer. But I would rather, you know, get to know the guy behind the little tent in the farmer's market and what he's about than trust a government sticker that says USDA certified organic. I think that that's, if it's possible, that's a way to go, and it also increases your, it's kind of fun. It makes shopping an interactive experience, not just sort of a passive.
Right. Well, you know, speaking as someone who spends part of the time in an urban setting, you know, yes, you can go to a farmer's market, but even today, without going to a farmer's market, you can stop eating quote-unquote organic energy bars, you know. You know, you don't have to, you know, if you don't have the time or the leisure or the access to go meet farmers, which, you know, I highly recommend that too. They're extraordinary people. And, you know, the people growing our food really are deserving of tremendous honor. But if you don't have time for that, look at your shopping list, you know, and cut out some of the schlocky items, you know, that are, you know, that maybe aren't really real food to begin with, or, you know, if they're little TV dinners, or if it's, you know, cut out some of those items, because actually, you know, in some cases, it's big organic dairy companies who are playing both sides of this, and in others, it's really folks who are, you know, using the organic label to sell, you know, dish towels or energy bars or air sets, cereal mixes, or, you know, like a whole, all different kinds of auxiliary products that maybe aren't strictly necessary. So, you know, that's something, you know, people could do right now. Clif Bar, the company Clif Bar, was a very poor player. And I think, you know, instead of being shy and apolitical and everything, we have to really be ready to name names and talk about the companies who undermine something that, you know, multiple generations of farmers and, you know, 25 years worth of consumer choice and support has built. Anyway, we're coming to, that's my little hobby horse, we're coming to the end of our show time. It's been great, Barry, having you with us today. And tell us, you have a more recent book than Tomato Land as well. Could you just tell us that title? Because we're kind of down to the last 2 minutes of the show, but so people can look for it at Amazon or online.
It is. If people want to hold, this is probably not great advertising, but if people would want to hold off a fully revised and updated edition of Tomato Land, will be available this coming early summer.
Fantastic. Oh, that's great.
Because there's been lots of changes for the better in the 6 years since the original book came out, and I wanted to include those.
All right. Well, Tomato Land next summer, in the height of the tomato season. Thank you so much, Barry Estabrook, for being with us today on Connect the Dots. And, you know, we'll look forward to your you know, your next edition of the book and other writings. You can follow him on the website of his same name, where he posts articles, very, very knowledgeable and interesting. And thank you, listeners, for being with me today and with me and Barry for this edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. You can check out our archives for other stories about the recent changes in the food movement we've been discussing in the show at the Connect the Dots Podbean, that's with an N, .com. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Until next time, be well, heads up, keep marching forward, standing tall with all our...